Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending 17th of December 1922, reparations, the whole reparations, and nothing but reparations. Yes, you could call it a reparations special. Not in this episode, owing to time, ignorance or sloth. Lloyd George causes a kerfuffle by claiming that France wants to annex the Rhineland. The Ilford murder trial ends in death sentences. The Ku Klux Klan reach Oregon. The army inches towards the 24-hour clock. A communist ex-minister is arrested for burglary. And they're still digging up Tutankhamun. As you probably know, after the First World War, the Germans were required to pay for the damage. These payments were known as reparations. Unfortunately, the Germans are not paying them, and there's going to be a big conference to solve the issue. But before the big conference, Allied Prime Ministers, including one Benito Mussolini, met in London for a small conference. This broke up without agreement. Usefully, the Times has published a sort of story so far of reparations. This is from Tuesday, the 12th of December. The Treaty of Versailles, which came into force on January the 19th, 1920, did not fix the amount of reparation Germany was to pay, but prescribed that the Inter-Allied Reparation Commission, constituted by the treaty, was to notify the extent of Germany's obligation. Pending the determination of the claim, the German government was to pay, by the end of April 1921, the equivalent of 20 billion, that's a modern billion, gold marks, or £1 billion. Which is approximately 300 billion in today's money. In January 1921, an inter-Allied conference was held in Paris, when it was decided that Germany should pay to the Allies £11,300,000,000 in a period of 42 years. Okay, well, assuming that 1 ounce of gold is at the time worth £4.50, not that they would say £4.50 in those days, they would say £4.10, wouldn't they? That, according to my calculations, is the equivalent of 2,511 million ounces of gold, or 3.8 trillion of today's pounds. It goes on. In April 1921, the Reparation Commission, which had reconsidered the matter, came to the conclusion that the damage for which Germany was responsible, exclusive of the cost of the armies of occupation, and certain sums attributed to Belgium, was 132 milliard gold marks, 6 billion 600 million. The manner in which payment was to be made was prescribed on May the 5th, and under threat that if Germany rejected the demand, the Ruhr Valley would be occupied. So that sum of 6 billion or so, I reckon, is 1,467 million ounces of gold, or 2.2 trillion pounds in today's money. So it's a considerable reduction. It goes on. The schedule of payment drawn up by the Reparation Commission prescribed the payment of a fixed annuity in quarterly instalments of 2 million of gold marks, 100 million pounds, and a variable annuity equivalent to 26% of the value of German exports. So that sum is about 20 million ounces of gold, or 30 billion pounds in today's money. He goes on. Germany discharged all the obligations imposed upon her for 1921. Well, I'm not surprised, because 30 billion pounds does not strike me as a difficult sum for a government to pay. Certainly not of the size of Germany. Yes, okay, we have to make some allowance for the fact that populations have increased and that productivity has increased, but even then, that is not an outrageous sum. I believe in this country we spend something like 100 billion a year on the NHS, for instance. So it's lower than that. Anyway, the article goes on. Following the fall of the mark, the German government sought a modification of the payments. At the beginning of this year, the question was considered at a meeting of the Supreme Council at Cannes, and on March the 21st last, the Reparation Commission imposed upon Germany the modified obligation to pay in 1922 in monthly instalments the sum of £36 million in cash and the equivalent of £72,500,000 in kind. It doesn't explain what is meant by in kind. It might be putting up the armies of occupation, although for reasons we'll come to, maybe not. Maybe goods, maybe coal from the Tsar, or is that not part of the deal? I don't know. The article doesn't explain, but maybe one day we'll find out. It goes on. On July the 12th, the German government asked for a moratorium. The article then goes to discuss the issuance of bonds. I'm not quite sure what this is all about. Is it that the Allied governments are issuing bonds on the understanding that they will be repaid for money from Germany? I don't know. Anyway, it goes on. The percentage of the bonds attributed to the countries named was France 52, the British Empire 22, Italy 10, Belgium 8, all other countries 8. In the House of Commons on August the 3rd last, Sir Robert Horne, then Chancellor of the Exchequer, stated that since the armistice, Germany had paid in cash or otherwise amounts which represented £415 million. Of this sum, Britain had obtained £56 million sterling, and practically the whole of that amount had been spent on the army of occupation. Or to put it another way, as far as Britain is concerned, reparations barely covers its own costs. By the way, that sum of 56 million, according to my calculations, represents 13% of the total, and not the 22% that Britain should be getting, at least according to my reading of this article. No idea why. There's also perhaps a more important observation to make here, is that Germany can pay, but refuses to pay. Anyway, on Friday the 15th, there was a big debate about this in the House of Commons. This is what the Prime Minister, Andrew Bonar-Law, had to say. The French, and indeed we, did also at one time, had great hopes in regard to the amount of money they would get from Germany. They had built upon those hopes to an extent that the financial system of France is based on receiving very large sums from Germany. Oh, this is bad news. It goes on. He goes on. Germany undertook to pay a certain amount. Almost nothing had been paid. They, he means the French, say that inflation was deliberately done by Germany. Well, honestly, I cannot myself think that this is true. For this reason, it is perfectly true that by the method of passive resistance they can avoid forever paying any indemnity, but they can only avoid it by what is very like suicide for Germany, and I can hardly believe that any sane government would deliberately adopt that course. Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. How often have I heard this, or how often have you heard this, projecting, this is Western politicians projecting their beliefs and their way of looking at the world onto others and finding out eventually that other people don't actually see the world in the same way. And crucially here, the Germans don't think they were responsible for the war. They thought it was a war of defence. And also, they don't think they lost it either. So they see no particular reason why they should pay for the damage. There's a period... There's a bit here where Bonar-Law talks about the entry of the United States to the war. The interesting thing from my point of view was that he was Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time. And he was looking at the numbers, and essentially he was preparing to go to the war cabinet, as it was, and say, look, guys, we've run out of money. And at that moment, the US, he received the news that the US had declared war. Which is odd, because you would have thought Britain could carry on for much longer than, say, Germany could. But it certainly makes the point that things were very tight, certainly in 1917. Anyway, he goes on. Owing to what I regard as the terrific misfortune of what has happened in Germany, the result has been that by destroying the middle class, for that is what has happened, the internal German debt has been wiped out. If she ever does recover, therefore, she is free from that terrible burden of internal debt which falls upon us. Well, yes. It's interesting, I think, here he's making that statement that the middle class is being destroyed. First of all, he's using the term middle class, which is a class, which is a communist term. I'm not sure that would have been used 50 years previously. But also it's a phrase that often gets used in... discussions of the German or the Weimar hyperinflation. So it's interesting. I'm just interested by its provenance. It's obviously used at that time. He goes on. All the information that I received, I am sorry to say it, but I believe it to be true, is to the effect that Germany is very near a complete collapse. All the information I get tends in that direction, and the tragedy of it is, I have not seen or heard this stated, but it is obvious that while it is undoubtedly certain that there can be no improvement in Germany at all until they have stabilised the mark, yet by all the experience of the world, including ourselves, in the last few years, by the opinion of every authority, the very effort to stabilise the mark will in itself bring about that collapse in industry from which we have suffered recently. Well, that's interesting to me. I mean, just because Britain is at the moment, in 1922, suffering from rather depressed conditions with high unemployment. And I wasn't quite sure why. So obviously, it rather looks as if interest rates have been put up in order to deal with inflation. I think they've been rather effective that, because prices are clearly falling. But anyway, and I think the other interesting thing is that I have never read of a general collapse in German industry in 1924 when they finally deal with the hyperinflation. But I assume it must have happened, because that's almost always what happens when you have inflation, you put up in interest rates to deal with inflation, and a lot of businesses go bust as a consequence. Anyway, in all this, Bonar Law is not offering any solutions. What he's really doing is demonstrating just how very difficult it is going to be to get any money out of the Germans, which, of course, is going to be the problem for, well, a good decade to come. Essentially, the populations of Britain and France want someone to pay for the costs they've incurred, and the governments know perfectly well they can't get that money. So I'm sure you can think of examples in the modern day where the population wants something and the government knows perfectly well it can't deliver it. On Wednesday, there's an article about the French point of view. This is from Wednesday the 13th of December. The Journal des Débats says that there has been too much talk of the Ruhr, as though the occupation of that region was the object instead of being merely the means. It is regarded here as giving productive pledges and as putting pressure on the Reich. That is a very odd wording. Either that's a very poorly worded sentence, or it's how they talked in those days. I haven't seen anything similar. Anyway, he goes on. The British, however, regard it as a useless, punitive expedition. This idea would not, the newspaper urges, have developed if England had been informed of the financial results expected and if the plan of financial control had been expounded. It then talks about France's options, ending with this. Another proposal is that if Germany is given a further trial and fails to satisfy the conditions laid down, and Great Britain still declines to participate in any system of pressure, then Great Britain should agree to allow France to take action. Although she would proceed alone, France would not proceed in defiance of England. Yep, the Entente Cordiale mattered. It matters to France, as you can see from this article, and also, if timed editorials are anything to go by, matters to England too. Anyway, that's all for this week. I hope you'll forgive me for indulging in one topic. That's not the aim, but I thought those three articles were very good and very important and very useful in understanding the issue of reparations from 1922's perspective. Because it's almost Christmas, I don't aim to have anything up as such next week, but as they say, never say never.